Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Mel Chin, who is a conceptual artist who's giving a lecture tonight and a workshop this week at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and we'll be joined by director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, Diane Karp. Right now, joining us by telephone, I'd like to welcome Mark Lloyd. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mark. You're from the Center for American Progress, and the Center for American Progress recently released a report called The Structural Imbalance of Political Talk Radio. What is the imbalance you're talking about, and how is it structural?
Well, part of what we looked at was the ownership of the top five radio group owners in the country and what percentage of conservative political talk they ran and what percentage of liberal talk they ran. We also looked at the top 10 radio markets in the country to find out, again, what percentage of political conservative talk was there and what percentage of political liberal talk was there. For the top five group owners, we found roughly 2,500 hours of conservative political talk and about 250 hours of liberal talk.
So that's 10 to 1.
Yeah. When we looked at the top 10 markets, we found it was a little better, about 75% conservative political talk versus about 25% liberal talk. Now, this balances out a little bit better in large markets like New York and Chicago, where the percentages are about 60 conservative to 40 liberal. But when you get to a market like Philadelphia, 100% conservative political talk, a market like Houston, 100% conservative political talk. And we think that these are problems related to ownership patterns, to the fact that you've got these large group owners, and many of them have some relationship with the syndicators of programs like Michael Savage and Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, and they are preferring to put on those programs to make money over and above in more independent programs or other syndicators like Air America. And so you've got, you have this really just sort of incredible imbalance of conservative talk radio. Again, not so much in Chicago and New York, but throughout other parts of the country.
You said you looked at the top five media owners. What percentage of the talk radio in the United States is owned by those top five media owners?
Roughly, it's well over 70% of the talk radio that's put out is put out by the top five folks. Most of the folks that are putting on programs on the air, they're focusing on music programs or they're not doing political talk. Maybe they're doing a local discussion programs like the program that you mentioned earlier about the local art scene in Santa Fe, but they're not doing necessarily political talk, where the parties are, who to vote for, that sort of thing. So it's a different sort of animal, and these group owners are really dominating that that market.
Now, a 90 to 10 ratio of conservative to liberal or progressive obviously doesn't reflect the balance in the listenership. If you look at our recent elections, the country's about 50% Democratic or on the progressive side. Why wouldn't there be a commercial interest in reaching more progressive people via radio if the medium is a commercial medium?
Well, again, there, to be fair, there are some commercial owners. A Clear Channel, one of the biggest owners, does put on some progressive talk. But the pressures from the advertising groups, again, the relationship between the owners and the syndicated products that they put on the air, I know this gets very complicated for listeners, it creates strong incentives for them to put on these conservative talks. It has nothing to do with the listener or the preferences of the listeners so much as the preference of the advertisers sometimes or the preferences of the syndicators, again, in their relationship with the owners. And so again, you end up with these sort of structural reasons that warp the market, that make what we think of as the market, the free market in radio or media, not work really well.
I think there's always a red flag raised when the money-making incentive is eclipsed by other concerns. When you talk about this radio, this relationship between the owners and the political product, like Rush Limbaugh or some of these other, what is that relationship like, and what is the advertiser's stake in all this? Since, you know, progressives and conservatives alike, you know, drink soda and buy soap and all the things that they're advertising.
part of what happens is that you establish a product like Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. The advertisers have some sense of what these folks can deliver, the products that they're representing in the market, the soap folks and the car manufacturers and the people who are selling pharmaceuticals. They know what they're getting, and they say, we want to buy Rush. We want to buy Sean Hannity. This is what we're going to do for this region or for this market, and if you carry these programs, we'll support you. If you don't carry those programs, but you put on some unproven product or some local talent, we're not quite sure we're going to provide you with the resources. So that makes perfect sense. Another thing that tends to happen, particularly with progressive talk show hosts, is that they talk about environmental issues. They talk about labor issues. They talk about issues that sometimes the big corporations that are the advertisers aren't all that comfortable with. And so what happens is that they say, we're really not sure we want to be on a political talk show host that's complaining about the fact that we may be polluting the environment, or that, you know, we're pushing, you know, SUVs at consumers, or we're doing things that aren't safe or healthy for Americans. And so they say, we don't really want to support that program. We want to support programs that may be more in line with our desire to sell our products. And so the conservatives end up, again, with these very clear advantages in talk. That skews political discourse, that sort of changes the way Americans are able to think about important issues.
We're talking with Mark Lloyd, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. I do remember reading maybe last year sometime a list of advertisers who had signed on to a sheet saying that they would not ever advertise on Air America. Tell us about that. Are you aware of that?
Oh, yeah, no, there was a concerted campaign among a wide variety of folks on the right to say, you know, you don't want to support these guys on Air America. And they put pressure on the advertisers not to do it, and the advertisers signed up. Some of them knew what they were doing. Some of them didn't know what they were doing. They were just saying, yeah, get these guys off my, you know, off my phone lines and, you know, sign up. There isn't that amount of sophistication necessarily on the left about media. And they don't go after media the way that the right has done, you know, since Goldwater and Nixon. They just haven't done it.
Why is that? I mean, the left is not entirely devoid of brain cells or resources or the knowledge of the facts.
Well, one of the reasons they do it is that, like most Americans, they've been convinced that the media is liberal. And so if you're actually convinced that the media is liberal, then why would you go after the folks that you think are your friends? And so,
yeah, but I living out here in the provinces of Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the middle of the desert, know very well that the media is not liberal. How can anybody in Washington, D.C., who's progressive, capitulate to that tired idea?
I worked in the media for many years. I never thought it was particularly liberal, but I understand that it's liberal in some ways. I mean, you tend to have folks who are both working in the industry who tend to support ideas that are, you know, for making sure that women have rights and making sure that, you know, minorities are okay and things. But they tend not to be for. They tend not to be, you know, pro-life. They tend not to be. I understand the confusion, but it is a confusion. Part of it's a confusion of terms. But we've had media, we've had folks for years. There were folks in the Clinton administration who believed before they began to be attacked in the New York Times that the media was liberal. And when they were attacked, they were surprised. They didn't understand what was happening to them.
How many people, how many Americans actually listen to radio as opposed to TV, internet, and the plethora of other media, including print media?
Well, most Americans, there are more Americans who sample media at some point in time during the day or the week than sample any other media. It is extraordinarily
meaning
powerful.
Radio.
That's right. That's right. Because unlike the internet, unlike television, unlike other media, it's available in cars where, unfortunately, most of us are trapped getting to or for from work or other errands and things. And so we listen to radio. It does not necessarily influence us to the same degree that local television does, but it's pretty strong. Internet reliance is still down there. I mean, I think it may now have reached to the teens, but it is not something that the vast majority of Americans rely on for their news and information sources as the primary source of information. It's
so
still
when you say
very,
the,
very powerful.
So you, when you say the teens, you mean like 15% of Americans use the internet to get their news?
Occasionally, but again, they don't necessarily rely on the internet for that. And even during the attack on the World Trade Center by these crazies from the Taliban, even the folks who rely on the internet went immediately over to television to watch what was going on. So the primary source of information remains television. More people sample during the week radio. Broadcast media continues to dominate. Even when people watch cable, most of the programs that they're watching on cable are local television programs or brought to them by the networks through local stations. And so, again, broadcast media remains the dominant media in the United States.
Now, the issue you bring up in your report is the issue of licensing. This station, KSFR, had to go through a procedure to renew its license recently. There's a whole process with the FCC. What are the rules under which public and commercial stations are licensed to broadcast, and how are these rules enforced?
Well, right now, there's a difference between the way public television stations and radio stations are licensed as opposed to commercial stations. Commercial stations right now, and this is really what we focused on, they get their license renewed through something called postcard renewal. They get a sheet of paper, and they cut out a slip of it, and they mark a box that they are financially solvent, essentially, and that they haven't done anything that, you know, should warrant taking away their license. And by and large, that's the only evidence that the FCC has in front of them about whether they ought to get their license, and they get their license again. Again, that process occurs now every 8 years for radio stations. It is a free license. They can't buy or sell licenses. The federal government doesn't buy or sell licenses from stations. And in exchange for that free license, again, that's renewed by postcard every 8 years without any input these days from the public, they're supposed to operate in the public interest. So part of the argument that we've been making is that if they're still supposed to be operating on behalf of the public interest in exchange for this very valuable license that they get for free, one of the things that they ought to do is to make sure they're responding to the local needs of the local community. And if they're not willing to do that, then they should pay for that license. But they can't have it both ways. They can't say, yes, we're operating on behalf of the local public interest, but we really don't want any teeth in the licensing rules. We really don't want to have to serve the local community. We really don't want to have any challenges to our licenses. So, you know, just sort of let us say we're operating in the public interest without really having any challenges to us about it.
And so is there, I mean, this is a recommendation that you have in your report at the Center for American Progress, the Structural Imbalance of Political Talk Radio. Is there a movement afoot to have local input into the licensing and the operation of commercial radio stations?
Well, there is a movement afoot, and it's connected to the movement that was really sort of sparked by Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC, several years ago. In 2003, once he thought he was going to put in rules to change the ownership structure to allow more local stations to be owned by more conglomerates, to essentially eliminate the band between newspaper and radio and television cross-ownership. So once he put those rules into place, the FCC got back hundreds of thousands of emails and letters and complaints, and people went to members of Congress and said, what are you guys doing? How can you allow this to take place? And as a result of that, Congress stepped in and said, you know, Michael Powell, the FCC, you can't put these ownership rules in place. And the court stepped in and said these ownership rules really sort of violate what it is that the FCC is supposed to be doing on behalf of the public. And then Michael Powell said, well, I guess we better start looking at localism. We better start looking at whether or not the rules that we've got in place are actually serving local interests. And so we've had these proceedings that the FCC has been conducting, these hearings going on around the country in, you know, small towns and big cities around the country for the last 3 or 4 years, where folks have been testifying about the lack of really input from the local communities and what the local stations are doing, about the lack of local service, about the if it bleeds, it leads newscasts. And what we've been getting at the FCC is saying, well, you know, maybe we need to do something about these local ownership rules. And folks in Congress are now actually considering whether or not they ought to require the FCC to do something. And so there is a movement afoot. It's largely driven not by the FCC, not by Congress, but by local citizens who are concerned about what they see as a takeover of the public airwaves and about the need to do something about it.
Now, your report states that an analysis conducted by Free Press of all the commercial licensed commercial radio stations in the country reveals that stations that are owned by women, minorities, or local owners are statistically less likely to air conservative hosts or shows. How does that work?
Well, part of what we have found, and again working with Free Press on this, is that if you have more small group owners, more local owners, a more diverse pool of candidates who actually own and determine what the local radio stations do, they tend to put on programs that actually serve the local communities. They tend to put on programs that are not, you know, part of this giant machine of the advertising industries and the syndicators and the big group owners. They tend to put on quirky programs. They tend to put on programs that reflect their interests, that actually reflect the interests of the local community and the local advertisers and the local small business groups that actually want to get on the air. It's the way that we thought radio and broadcasting was supposed to operate from the beginning, that it wasn't going to be this big, you know, giant conglomerate of, you know, big advertisers and big buyers and, you know, and group owners and syndicators determining what the local folks got. So the women and the minorities tend to be small groups, small independent stations, and they tend to put on programs that actually serve the local communities. And so what we're calling for is that we need to change the ownership rules. We need to make sure that we've got a more diverse pool. We need to make sure that local communities have more impact on the licensing process, and that we think that will address what's happening with the lack of local content and the dominance of conservative talk in markets around the country.
We're talking to Mark Lloyd of the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. There's two different things there that you're talking about. One is having more local content that serves a community, as we have a whole lot of here on KSFR. The other is having a balance of conservative and progressive talk, which is often, I mean, the imbalance we're talking about is not about local politics, it's about national politics. What do you think are the proper rules that would ensure a balance that reflects the population's political views of conservative, liberal, to progressive national dialogue?
Well, I must admit that I really just sort of try to veer away from, you know, this notion of making sure that, you know, we have an equal amount of time for conservative or political talk. Part of what we were really trying to show was that there was a real imbalance and that what we hope will happen is that not trying to stay away from concerns of the First Amendment and free speech, what we hope will happen is that if you've got more local talk, if you've got the stations that are more responsive to the local communities, then they will find the right balance for that particular community. If you've got local input, if you've got real teeth into the licensing process, we really don't think that the federal government ought to be involved in determining whether or not individual local stations are putting, 50% conservative talk and 50% liberal talk. And part of our concern about this, as a progressive think tank, as a liberal organization, quote unquote, is that we're concerned about what happens when the Republicans are in charge and what policies they'll put in place and how they'll determine balance. So we just don't think the federal government ought to be involved in that. Let's make sure that there are intelligent ownership rules. Let's make sure that the local communities, however those local communities are balanced themselves, that they have input into the licensing process, and then let's let it work out. We're not uncomfortable with, again, the balance that we see in New York and Chicago. We are uncomfortable with 100% conservative talk in Philadelphia. And so we need to get the folks in Philadelphia to really have some power vis-a-vis that local set of stations in Philadelphia to get more balance in the market, not with a particular station, but in the radio market itself.
One thing that we're sort of dancing around is this concept of the fairness doctrine. The reason I called you in the first place was because I keep getting, I get a lot of emails from all sorts of organizations and people whom I've never met in my inbox. And one theme that keeps on coming up is this idea that somehow Democrats in Congress are trying to reinstate the fairness doctrine, which was struck down by the Supreme Court, indeed, and I believe in a decision by Justice William Brennan, over 20 years ago. What was the fairness doctrine, and is anybody actually trying to bring it back?
Well, let's make it clear that the fairness doctrine has never been struck down by the courts.
Is that not true?
No. The fairness doctrine has never been struck down by the courts. In a decision about Metro Broadcasting, Justice Brennan suggested that, we should relook at the fairness doctrine, whether or not it's applicable. But we've also had, unfortunately I'm a lawyer, so I don't want to go into too much detail here, but we had a Court of Appeals decision that said that the FCC had the authority to make a decision about whether or not to apply the fairness doctrine, which is not about repealing the fairness doctrine, which was just saying, yes, the FCC, the expert administrative agency of the federal government that rules over broadcasting and telephone companies, yes, they've got the authority to determine what rules they're going to put in place and what rules they aren't going to put in place. I mean, that's all the courts have said so far. The FCC can determine this.
So it was the FCC that actually withdrew its application.
The FCC decided that it would not apply specific provisions under that very loose term called the Fairness Doctrine. The core notions of the Fairness Doctrine, that broadcasters are given a free license to serve the public interest, and that the public interest means that they need to provide local issues of importance in a fair and balanced way, is still in place. And that's okay law. It's been very loosely enforced by the FCC over 80 years of regulation. It didn't start in 1949, as many people say, but it has no teeth. I mean, the problem with the Fairness Doctrine is not that that the notion that local stations get a license to operate in the public interest is bad. The problem is, what does that mean if you've got a licensing process that says, well, we're only going to open the license up every 8 years, that the public really has no place in determining whether the local station is actually serving the local public interest? And so we want to put some teeth back into those rules. The Fairness Doctrine, I don't know how it would apply in today's world, but it has no teeth. We need to make sure that people are involved in that process. We need to be able to cut down these gigantic group owners and get more local, small groups owning stations around the country.
I think it's also important to talk about what's at the heart of this, namely that people get their opinions from the media, and what they hear most is what they're most likely to take on as their own. How does that process work?
Oh, I think that's right. What is so important, particularly about broadcasting, which is still the dominant media despite the presence of the Internet. You're not going to get the Internet usually in your car. The radio is still extraordinarily important media, and so is television. And because of the dominance of this media, and because the licenses are free and the airways are still owned by the public, broadcasters have an obligation. And so what we're wrestling with is, in the modern era, how do we make sure that the broadcasters actually serve the local public interest? And these are important questions to wrestle with, and it's an important conversation to engage in, there's no question in the courts, when you look at the history of regulation, that the First Amendment, that all of these rules take into account that public opinion matters, and that public opinion is formed through local discussion, through trusted resources, through, we hope, fair news, through balanced news, that the public can't decide on issues if it doesn't know the issues that are happening. So we need a discussion of those issues. We need to know what's going on. And that's why it's not just the First Amendment rights of the broadcasters that are in question here. It's really the First Amendment rights of the listeners and the viewers that the court needs to balance, because opinion is so important in this country.
And I think it's also important for listeners and for the public to understand and be able to detect bias. I was in the dentist office the other day. Fox News was on, and I said, you know, that's pretty biased, Fox News. And one of the people in the dentist office says, oh, it's just news.
Well, yeah, the challenge is that in addition to the problems of media, we really need to begin to teach in our schools some ability to critique media and some responsibility among citizens to sample diverse media so that they are listening or watching not only Fox, but they're watching CBS and they're listening to NPR and they're reading the Wall Street Journal and they're sampling
under
different
Murdoch's
sorts of
ownership.
News. That's right. I mean, if we can make sure that citizens understand that if they're relying on any one source of news, that they are subject to whatever bias that owner or that reporter or that producer may have, that it's important for them to try to get a balance of perspectives and then for them to make up their own mind.
Mark Lloyd, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Congratulations on the program.
Thank you. Mark Lloyd is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. They recently released a report called The Structural Imbalance of Political Talk Radio. That and much more can be found on the web at americanprogress.org. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome conceptual artist Mel Chin. He is giving a lecture tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6 o'clock, actually at Tipton Hall, and he's teaching a workshop this week. And Diane Karp is also with us from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. It's good to be here in Santa Fe.
It's great to have you here. Now, you are a conceptual artist. How do you go from being an artist trained in drawing and painting and so on to being a conceptual artist?
Well, you don't go on. You continue on. And you actually make sure that those things on paper, paint, or medium is concept-driven. They're delivered by an idea first. So the idea is primary. And then the means or the media or the techniques to deliver the idea.
So what was your path of art making like from the time you were young until the time you became the type of artist that you are now? We're going to be speaking about your work.
I was always able to render something, and so therefore it starts with the idea that you might have some talent, right? But that really doesn't constitute being an artist. Actually, I think when I went to college in Nashville, Tennessee, I got heavily into clay. I got so crazy about it. I was almost like a psychoceramicist, and I was driven by this idea, but of the medium, only that. And then, but because you sink heavily into something like that, and then it opens up the world of cultures that may be lost, from everything from Chan Buddhism to Marcel Duchamp, to his associations, to historic associations. So you then I realized that the whole world is liberated through this kind of focused, preoccupation.
Preoccupation, for example, in that case, with really working with clay, with that medium.
Well, yeah. Well, you become like mud crazy, and then you know that it kind of opens you up by saying, well, you can start with this kind of contrary notion. Maybe then, if you really know the medium, then maybe sometimes it's inadequate to describe what you must. That's what I mean. And then you might have to find another methodology for that. So applying the capacities for eclectic and rapid mutation allows for something else to happen.
So in a concrete level, what does that mean? What were you doing?
I could be making large salt glaze forms, but then I would start reading about contemporary art history, conceptual art, and you would have kinetic art, earthworks, and then you would say, well, maybe I can combine those into one piece, where you could have a landscape that would be activated by people, performance art, that you could stand on and the earth would rise and fall. It became the seesaw piece that was built in the 70s in Houston, because I did that with an oil company. I convinced the oil company in Texas to build this thing. We put it into a my first big monumental sculpture exhibition, and I think it was 74, 76 in Houston, Texas, and it was in a park, and it was I was very clear about my intention. No labeling, let it be discovered. So the judges walked right by it. They never...
What did it look like?
Well, it was 2 6-foot cutouts in the park ground that were like planters that were sunk level. If you stood in one would sink and the other one would rise 30 feet away. They were two, separated by this situation. So it was like this see and saw kind of playground within the grounds.
So somebody walking through the park would stand on one part, it would sink,
and the other
were they a little disconcerted by that?
It would go really slow. I was interested in the psychological and the physiological. And people that discovered it then became overly excited. And you would have sometimes 20 kids jumping on it, watching it react, and the other crowd jumping on the other. It was something to be seen. But my labeling process allowed it not to be known. And that's a caveat. If you really have something you want to show, make sure to let people know about it.
So your non-labeling process meant that a lot of people didn't discover it who might otherwise.
Right. But now in my older years, I guess, I feel that some things must be unlabeled. Yeah, because I think that, especially in the field of activism, I just overheard some of your conversations about news, and there was a notion about how we must educate, we must, get people to see alternatives. But sometimes I think it's about reanimating desire to do that, and if the arts are something that can be made to present that or possibility, then it's an option, but maybe that's worthy. And it remains, sometimes we're so tied up with the cult of personality that you're the so-called...
Diane Karp is giggling about the cult of personality.
Yeah, well, so it has to be assigned, the assignation of the artist, and sometimes it's good to just drop out.
Well, I mean, the history of art until, the last 500 years is the history of anonymous artists.
Right. No, well, maybe before that, and I think that's wonderful that that history has educated us a lot and has reanimated my desire to understand that. And it's like the anonymity of, especially of public art, is important, and that can be applied to conceptual explorations in the field. There's field work, and then there's museum work, and there's all kinds of work to be done.
Yeah. We're talking to Mel Chin, conceptual artist, who will be giving a lecture tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall under the auspices of the Santa Fe Art Institute. You have done a piece which is ongoing. I believe it started in 1990. It's a field. I believe it's called Revival Field.
It is called Revival.
Tell us about that piece.
Well, Revival Field is actually, there's no field right now. It's more not, it is a concept.
There's not a field.
There's not a field.
I saw a picture of the field.
Well, there was a field. That was a three-year replicated field test site. That was in 1991 to 1993 at Pigside Landfill. Then it went to Palmerton, Pennsylvania, next to a Superfund site for about another 5 years. Then it went to Germany for a couple of years. What was important about Revival Field was during the period of its invention, which is the premise that if plants could pull heavy metals out of the soil, then they could, at enough volume, then they could function as soil cleaners and change the environment, revive the environment as is. The notion of this, that at such a degree, by the way, where the plant could be harvested and smelted for ore to pay for the process.
Hang on a second. So what we're talking about is taking extremely toxic, polluted ground, putting plants in it, which are called hyperaccumulators, which draw heavy metals into the plants,
right,
harvesting the plants, drawing ore out of them for metal, and then having the ground that remains be unpolluted.
Cleaner. I mean, I think it's a heavily managed process. As you said, hyperaccumulator, that's the correct term. They're highly specialized ecotypes. You just can't plant any
dandelions.
Right. And there's a lot of misconception about it. But when it was started, the one scientist that in the United States that knew about it, Dr. Rufus L. Cheney at the USDA, all his research was shelved. And,
why?
Have we ever been in a political climate that's been conservative? I don't know.
Well,
you have
certainly
that.
Not recently.
That's a conversation for the previous half hour.
Okay, well, but we get off that. But basically, when I first read about the idea, it was a psilocybin expert, Terrence McKenna, who... I tell the story a lot. Well, I had heard my first big museum show at the Hirshhorn Museum. I was going down in this elevator, and you have voices talking to you. You know, they say, "Well, what do you love to do?" "Well, I love researching things. I love making things, the objects, and getting in." This is my first big museum show, and the other voice said, "Okay, to stop." I said, "I listened to that other voice, so I stopped making work." And I roamed.
What was this voice that said stop?
This beautiful voice, the one I listened to.
The one inside your head.
Yeah. And so I stopped and didn't pick up a pencil, hammer, tool to make stuff, nothing. For about 6 months, and I roamed through the New York Public Library, the streets, and just was able to absorb whatever was coming to me. And it was that Whole Earth Review, I believe. It was it was Terrence McKenna's article on Datura, which is and its capacity.
Jimson weed,
and its cleaning capacity. I started researching and found there was no evidence that I could find for that. I know it's a unpredictable hallucinogenic.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, do not take it.
No,
I've looked this up.
Are you sure? Oh, you've tried?
No,
I haven't tried.
Don't smoke it.
But I was told by a Mexican guy in my neighborhood that if you make tea out of this and feed it to the person who you want to love you, they will love you. So I thought, well, you know, that's a marketable commodity, but let me look this up on the internet, and it's really bad for you.
It's really bad. It's poison.
it's got various alkaloids that you shouldn't take, and it's mixed. The mix is wrong. I was in New York. I went back to Texas. There was a landfill specialist that knew about Jimson weed, and he said, "No, there's no evidence," and that he knew of. But he said, "But there is this guy named Cheney at USDA, and you should call him because we heard a paper about this hyperaccumulator stuff." I called him. He was working in the sludge reclamation, and when I asked about it, he said, "Well, that might get you high, but it won't pick up the metals."
Yeah. The pollution.
And I said, "Well, you know, when I thought about plants, if plants could possibly do this and take metal from the soil and clean the soil, because there was no solution to this problem at the time, then that poetry was amazing in itself. But the poetry was so amazing that it obligated a pragmatic direction that I had to make sure.
Wait, you're introducing poetry. What poetry was that?
The poetry that if this simple plant can transform the ecology of a toxic environment, that's quite amazing.
So this is a hypothetical plant because they're telling you that Jimson weed doesn't do
right.
that.
Right, but then I said if that starts with poetry. I was like this nut that they're walking around, you know, galleries or shows, and they are friends, and they said, well, how are you doing? And I was like the guy in The Graduate that approached Dustin Hoffman and said, plastics. I said, it's plants. You know, plants. And they said, yeah, man, you just got to chill out and make art.
Get a grip.
I said, it is art. It is art because the conceptual parameters of this possibility was so invigorating that I said it had to be explored. You know, well, Dr. Cheney said that won't do it, but I know what will. And this really got me excited. But then it became apparent that his idea of art was not formed very well at the time, and he was coming up with other ideas. And I just said, well, no, it's really, why haven't you done yours? And he said, well, it's shelved. I can't get support for it. I said, well, maybe through the NEA. If we can't do it through USDA, we'll do it through NEA, and I'll create a conceptual project for the Inner Arts Program, and we'll be able to execute.
So you actually had these fields that were toxic. You actually planted these hyperaccumulating plants in them. Did they, in fact, draw the bad stuff out of the soil?
This is what was necessary to make science. See, basically what Revival Field was confirmed scientific process. It was the first replicated field test in the United States. Just like code fusion, you could talk about it, you could have it, but it has to be replicated for the scientific community to accept it as reality. And so the job, this description, was to create the first replicated field test in the world. And that was the job of Revival Field, to actually confirm that there would be uptake at that St. Paul pig's eye landfill that was closed since the 70s for cadmium contamination, and to make sure that, see if these plants would work. It took 3 years, and we finally got results in the second and third year, and that was the confirmation that was necessary. There was also the NEA veto of the grant that led to the first article in Science, and when the scientists got hold of this idea, everybody that was working in the field started coming out. So it really, I say Revival Field is not just mine, but the work of hundreds of scientists that were laying and waiting for a moment where they could really expose what their research was about. So.
Now, has the effect of this been that hyperaccumulator plants are being studied and used?
Oh, yeah. Well, there is several businesses that have started around this, and one is actually using a hyperaccumulator to collect nickel in some of these western areas that are polluted with nickel. There's different ways of now approaching. Well, it's basically it established a solution that is viable for plants, specific plants, that can pull metals to this degree. And that's what the contribution of Revival Field was. So therefore, it's like that's the concept where the physical formal configurations were important to establish a presence. But it was more than in the art world, I was focused on how can this effort supply the data to establish a presence in, a presence in the scientific community.
I'm
part of it.
We're talking to Mel Chin, and it's actually just about time to go. The lecture is going to be tonight. What are you talking about tonight? Tonight at 6 o'clock.
It's a secret. Everyone's got to come.
What's the title of the lecture?
There's no real title, but I think it's Comfort Zone is the show, so I'll probably be discussing some uncomfortable things.
Some uncomfortable things that are in the show Comfort Zone, in which you have a piece, and if
which
people haven't seen it yet.
Which is still open for another week and a half.
Excellent, and that's at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is right next to Tipton Hall, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. I'm sorry we didn't have more time. Mel Chin, it's wonderful to have you on the air.
Right.
And Diane Karp, director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, always wonderful to have you here, too.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So once again, tonight at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute at Tipton Hall is the lecture, and sfai.org is the website, and you can also call 424-5050. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my website where you can listen to the show any time of day or night or early morning or afternoon. And all of that thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the direction of the marvelous Bill Dupuis. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista.